This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. Today on the program, Marisa Waddell talks with American Indian activist and widow of Russell Means, Pearl Danette Claw Means, who will speak in Santa Maria this Saturday. Also, we'll hear about allergy-free gardening from Julie Wheelock, and Mary Schiller takes us on a spring cleaning trip to the Nipomo Swap Meet. But first, California might be described as having five seasons. The fifth, it's fire season, and this year the conditions are particularly ominous. The huge fire in Ventura County may be a harbinger of the future. Lynn Deal discovered that California firefighters are applying years of know-how to switch tactics and save neighborhoods that are surrounded by wildlands. But one of the most important elements in safeguarding people and places begins with you.
So far this year, firefighters have been called out to nearly 800 wildfires, around 45% beyond normal, and those numbers are climbing every day. They include the Springs Fire in Camarillo, which burned from mountain to sea. Innovative tactics and plain old tried and true firefights helped save homes and critical technology perched above Point Magoo. This is Lynn Deal for Issues and Ideas. If you are within the sound of my voice, you're aware of the threat of devastating fire. A dry winter, this year is likely to go down as one of the driest on record, combined with low humidity and a mix of wildlands, homes, businesses, and neighborhoods, sets the scene. History reminds us it can all blow up in a heartbeat. Those who have up-close experiences with advancing flames know it can be foolish or deadly to ignore the chance to prepare and protect your property now. I'm walking along Southwood Drive here on the eastern side of San Luis Obispo, where there's a pleasant view of steep hillsides and valleys beyond. The hillsides above and below these homes are still showing a bit of green here and there, but there's a lot of golden brown. That's dry vegetation. In July of 1985, the monster Las Palitas fire was bearing down on this neighborhood. Diane Filipponi and her husband Herb still live up on their ranch at the end of this street. She recently shared some pictures with me. In them, the sky was darkly orange and embers were blowing through the air. Even 28 years later, the wake-up call in the middle of the night, the smell of the smoke, and the mad dash to save people, animals, and property are vivid and frightening memories.
The first time we realized that the fire was actually going to come over the hill and down by our house was about 2 o'clock in the morning. A neighbor called. We couldn't see the flames, but a neighbor across Johnson Avenue saw the flames, and she said, I'm coming up because I think your house is going to burn. And I said, oh, no, no. And she said, yes, yes, it is. So we started evacuating our house at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so Herb was up on the hill trying to corral the llamas and the steers. We had 4-H animals here. It was so dark. I mean, even when it got light, it was dark because there was so much smoke and it was burning your eyes. And the cinders were dropping here and there.
The Filipponi's family and friends would try to wet down the roof, but the water evaporated as soon as it was applied. The dire situation was made clear by what firefighters told them.
We had one fire truck here. It was from Humboldt County. They had 500 gallons of water, and they said, when that's gone, it's gone.
There was smoke, ferocious hot wind, and eventually a wall of flames, flames that would shoot some 15 feet high above their roof.
So much confusion when that happens, and it did happen very, very quickly.
They were not alone in their struggle. Their neighbors faced the same circumstances.
The fire was all the way down Southwood Drive, so all the homes along Southwood Drive were also in jeopardy of burning, and people were trying to decide, you know, what to do and how to do it and where to go next.
The Filipponi's house is in a canyon located between two small seasonal creeks. The fire burned right up to the house on both sides.
The firemen were just astounded that our house was still here.
Diane Filipponi feels lucky. When the fire blew through, they had lost a few fences, two windows were blown out by the firestorm, but they had saved animals, people, and the house. But it wasn't all luck. The Filipponis had trimmed trees and removed dry vegetation in the slopes of those creek beds. Creating defensible space is a key element of whether firefighters can save structures or not.
we have never seen anything like that, and hopefully not again.
Fire season can be any season in California and the arid West. The actual declaration of fire season is a change in fire agencies' preparedness levels. That declaration was made here at the end of April. By some accounts, it comes 6 weeks earlier than usual. CAL FIRE Chief Robert Lewin provides insight on what we might prepare for this year.
The chief has quite a job. When you think about everything that he oversees, 3,200 square miles in San Luis Obispo County, more than 600 personnel, including full-time, seasonal, inmate, reserve, and volunteer firefighters. There are 21 fire stations, 2 conservation camps, an air attack base, and an emergency command center. And yet, when the call goes out anywhere in the state of California that there is a big incident, you just pick up and go where you go and do what you have to do. Chief, what was your role in Camarillo, and what did you find there?
Well, in fact, you're right, Lynn. The in CAL FIRE, we're much like the Marines. Everybody's an infantryman. It doesn't matter what your rank is. You have to maintain your qualifications and be ready to go to a fire. And while I don't get to be on the fire lines like I used to, I was called out immediately after the Springs Fire down in Ventura County got going, because it was burning on lands that are the responsibility of the state of CAL FIRE. We have a contract with Ventura County to provide that service, but we have to come down there and provide the resources, the surge resources for that, and then also, of course, pay for the expense of the fire. So my job down there was to administrate that.
There were 43 square miles that had burned. Obviously, it burned from the mountains to the sea. One of the firefighters was quoted in the Los Angeles Times as saying, because they recognized from 1993 that they weren't going to be able to outrun it, that they had to change tactics a bit. Can you explain exactly what happened and how that is applied? I know that you had a direct role in that.
Yeah, you know, firefighters want to, of course, defend structures, protect lives. That's our mission, protect lives, property, and natural resources. But in doing that, sometimes that's not the most effective way to actually extinguish the fire. So we have two kinds of tactics we use. One is defensive, and of course, one is offensive. The offensive one is going to more quickly put the fire out. But if you have to put all your resources into defending homes, infrastructure, those resources are tied up and you can't go aggressively on the flanks of the fire. So the change that he's referring to, I'm not sure it's much of a change, but it's a result of so many people living in the wildland that we've been forced into the defensive mode. And what we have to do now is pull ourselves out of that defensive mode as quickly as possible and go on the offensive on the flanks of the fire. It's sort of like asking any military strategic person about what they did when they were fighting the enemy in World War II. They would hit the flanks. No one would ever go on the frontal assault on the forces. They'd try to go to the flanks. They're weaker. It's the same on a fire. We want to hit the flanks where it's weaker, where the flames aren't as intense, work up the flanks, and then when we get to the head of the fire, pinch it off. But of course, if homes and lives are threatened, we just can't do that.
When you are talking about what you defend, I read at one point that you said the priority for you is always to protect lives, buildings, and then resources. You had a particular piece of property that had to be protected in Camarillo that was of strategic importance to multiple agencies, including the military, and you saved it.
Yeah, it was a very good experience in the fact that we got word a few hours into the fire starting that there was a billion-dollar communication site, radio site, at the head of the fire. And we only had a couple hours before the fire was going to be there. We were able to, first of all, we could identify the location because we're using very high technology now with infrared cameras on airplanes, as well as a software called Nix, which we can communicate via the internet with maps, much like a Google Earth environment. We were able to identify the site, quickly put bulldozers and hand crews up there to clear as much vegetation as we could, and then we deployed 10 fire engines up there. And when the fire hit, it hit quickly. Those firefighters were in a firefight up there. There was an ember storm. The wooden staircases into the facilities were catching on fire. The firefighters were able to protect all the facility up there, and they saved $1 billion just on that one site.
You might be wondering, what does this have to do with you? Well, we have a history of wildland fires that encroach into the urban areas and endanger all of us. More than 750,000 homes in the western U.S. have a high risk of wildfire damage, according to a report that was published in an insurance journal. That was for last year, 2012. This year, we have extreme dangers, I would say, because of the first 4 months, driest in 50 years. The projections are not good.
Yeah, that's correct. We're looking at conditions that are predicted to be very, very difficult this fire season. We already know it's going to be a long fire season. It's started a month before normal. The vegetation is as dry as it could be in July. So we're looking at very receptive fuel beds, if you will, for a fire. You know, there's three factors that influence fire. It's weather, fuel, and topography. Of course, we don't know what the weather's going to be. That's the one unknown. But we do know the fuels, the vegetation is dry this year. And of course, it's California, and especially on the coastal mountains here. It's very rugged, steep country. So we know we have that problem already. That's more extreme than usual with the dry vegetation. Now we're going to watch the weather, and that's going to really dictate what happens.
There are things that you can do. First off, native grasses are not as susceptible to dry and burn. Is that correct? I mean, don't plant non-native things first. Secondly, defensible area. The chief will talk a little bit more about it, but there are things that you can do to help protect your house. Defensible areas are important, and they're extremely important when you look at the pictures. Just go online to any news organization and see what it looks like as the fire burns up to houses. Chief, what can people do right now?
Well, there's several things they can do. Of course, the long term, as you're saying, is, you know, landscape your house properly. You know, make sure that you do have the right species of plants that are fire resistant. You know, I've seen fires where green lawns have burned because the fire conditions were so extreme, but that's not usual. What you want to make sure you do is you plant those types of species that will work in a fire environment. Oftentimes, those are actually natives. The native species, when they get some irrigation, and they don't usually need much, and they're pruned back, are actually not bad plants to have. We have plant lists on all of our websites that people can use. Okay, so get your houses ready. Make sure you have the right kind of roofs, your decking. You're not stockpiling a lot of wood, firewood next to your house, and those kinds of things. The next thing you want to do, of course, is make sure your family is ready. Talk about it. While you're at home, say, okay, if there's a fire and the cell phones are out, we have no way of communicating, where are we going to meet as a family so we can get back together? You want to have a plan. You also want to make sure you've already thought about, what are those things I want to grab as I'm leaving that are important to me? And they shouldn't be many. They need to fit in a car. What are we going to do with our horses? What are we going to do with our pets? What if you have someone in your family who has special needs that you need to take care of? You want to get those people out early so that you don't have to add extra stress to them.
Fire season is declared now. Is it 6 weeks ahead? Is it about the same? What does that mean for our area? We have more crews on, or what?
Yeah, we've gone to what we refer to as peak staffing, which means that we have all of our seasonal fire engines now covered. Our air tanker base at Paso Robles has both air tankers and its air tactical plane ready to respond. Our hand crews have been through readiness exercises. They're in top condition. They're ready to fight fire, and they have. They were all deployed down to Ventura. We had 150 people in Ventura and Riverside this last week from this county on fires. We're ready to go. We're prepared. The big question is the citizens, are they prepared? Do they have clearance? Are they ready for fire season?
You've been listening to Cal Fire Chief Robert Lewin. Tips and guidelines to help safeguard your property are available online at calfire.ca.gov. I'm Lynn Deal for Issues and Ideas.
You are listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Still to come on Issues and Ideas, learn about plants for your garden that are less likely to cause allergies. Up next, Marisa Waddell speaks with Pearl Danette Claw Means about the work she's doing to continue the vision of American Indian activist Russell Means. In October,
The World lost a man described as the most famous American Indian since Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. Russell Means was Lakota from South Dakota and came to prominence in the late 60s as part of the American Indian Movement, or AIM. He became active internationally and worked with the UN, fighting for the rights of indigenous peoples. He was a controversial figure, participating in occupations at Alcatraz, Mount Rushmore, and most famously at Wounded Knee, where the armed standoff lasted for 71 days. Russell Means fought against broken treaties and abusive legislation, such as forced sterilization of Indian women. He fought for the return of stolen land, and he fought to preserve Indian culture. He opened a health clinic, a radio station, and was working toward building a school when he passed away. Russell Means was also politically active, running for president of the United States and governor of New Mexico. He was an actor, appearing in several films. He was a musician, a writer, and he was an avid painter. I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. My guests today are Pearl Means, the widow of Russell Means, and his collaborator, editor of his last book, and Lourdes Espinosa, who is from Santa Maria and who was inspired by Russell Means. Lourdes has invited Pearl Means to speak this coming Saturday at the Bookworm in Santa Maria. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pearl, will you first tell me a little bit about yourself and about how you met Russell Means?
Certainly. My name is Pearl Dinetkla Means. I come from the Navajo Nation. I was born into the Salt Clan. I met Russell Means May 8, 1998, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He was part of a small group of writers and directors who the New Mexico Film Commission had brought in to market our area. We were doing a lot of filming at that time. I was representing a property in New Mexico, and we had accommodated a lot of high-end films. And so I was asked if I would sponsor a brunch on a historic train ride from Santa Fe to Lamy, New Mexico, where the small group would be taken out to a couple of our movie sets. They were former large ranches, and they had been turned into movie sets. So that's where I met Russell Means.
And tell me, what was it about Russell Means that attracted you enough that you married him?
Well, as an indigenous person in the dominant society, any time we have an opportunity to interact with another indigenous person, it's always a treat. Having been a teenager in the early 70s, you know, I was very familiar with him, as all American Indians, especially of that time, as being a leader with the American Indian movement. And how exhilarating. And that was the beginning of restoring our dignity, our pride, throughout Indian country and the indigenous world. So we began a dialogue and immediately connected.
Lourdes Espinosa, you have been inspired by Russell Means, and I'd like to hear your story. How did you meet Russell Means, and why is he so inspiring to you that you've brought Pearl Means back now? This is the second time to speak to the Central Coast.
I met him later on in my life, but I think my story with Russell began when I was a child. At the time, I must have been about 11, and I heard of Russell through friends of mine, one of them in particular, Henrietta, who was African-American, and I believe it was Cherokee Indian. So her family was very much involved with AIM, and she would always mention Dennis Banks and Russell, and, you know, it got me interested. And then also via the magic of TV, we'd watch the news, and of course, only my father knew some English. My mother hardly spoke any word, but I had to translate for my parents. Mm-hmm. My father wanted to be, you know, informed, and my mother did too, so I had to do a lot of translation for them. There was one day in particular when I remember watching TV, and lo and behold, on the news, there is Russell with none other than Ted Kennedy. I still remember the image. And my father wanted to know what he was saying. He pointed to him and he said, "You need to listen to what he's saying." And also, it's also about honoring my grandparents and, you know, my ancestors, because on my father's side, we are Otomi. And that's the indigenous part of me that I cannot let it pass away.
And Otomi is from where?
It is from Mexico. And I firmly felt that he spoke to that part of me that for so long had been silenced. And that was the indigenous part of me, because English is not my first language, neither is Spanish. It was my Otomi language. And I believe that that was why I had to meet Russell, because he inspired me in that way, that he spoke about a truth that we don't speak about now, at least in, not, like Pearl says, in the dominant society. My grandparents spoke of that truth, you know, the old ways of being, the traditions, so much knowledge, so much wisdom that gets buried. I want to keep that alive for my children, for my grandson, for many generations. I work with children, and it's tragic to see that sometimes they are ashamed of their heritage. They are ashamed to speak their mother language. And little by little, you see them kind of fading away. That indigenous part of them gets zeroed out, and it's a shame.
Well, let's talk about that. I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. My guests today are Pearl Danette-Claw Means, the widow of Russell Means, and Lourdes Espinosa, who is from Santa Maria and who was inspired by Russell Means. Pearl Means, you're going to be presenting Russell Means' book. It's going to be a signing at 1 o'clock and a presentation at 3 o'clock at the Bookworm in Santa Maria this coming Saturday. The title of this book with Bayer Johnson is If You've Forgotten the Names of the Clouds, You've Lost Your Way. Now, it seems to me to be a call to American Indians, but especially to the Lakota, to remember their language and their culture. What does remembering do?
To remember is to not lose the essence of who we are as distinctive people. The language is so connected and tied to us and our DNA that Russell felt an urgency to get the word out to his people, to the indigenous community, that as we lose our language, and the average speaker is 65, and on his homeland, the Lakota people, the life expectancy is 43 and a half for men and 52 for women.
Wow.
So essentially the language is lost. That is definitely part of our essence. The other part of that equation is that we're oral people. We come from an oral society, which encourages and requires children to use both sides of the brain simultaneously. So this is why our people are fantastic artists. It's really incredible how gifted our people are with our songs, our dance, our language, our art, our orator skills.
Russell Means said that he learned from elders who counseled him. Pearl, who did you learn from about your culture?
I'm Dene. The Spanish called us Navajos, and that's what we still are referred to today. But in our language, Dene is the people. My mother, we're still to this day, I'm very proud that we still live and adhere to a matrilineal system, which is part of our survival, and it's part of the balance that we were able to maintain as indigenous peoples. My mother had the opportunity to have her great-grandmother live with them, and she had a great deal of influence over her, and then it continues to the subsequent generation.
That's something that Russell focuses on in his book of last year, the matrilineal law and the matriarchal perspective. Can you please tell me about the matriarchal perspective and what it means to American Indian culture and to other cultures?
Well, when a man marries, he knows that he will go to where the woman is from because the woman needs the support of the community, family and community, to raise our children. We need that influence and that stability. We as women, we live longer than our male counterpart. So when our husband departs, we're still within the comfort and the family of our people. And so that's significant. It also is the absolute opposite of the patriarchal systems and structures that have been built and crumbled for eons, you know, from the Ming Dynasty to what's happening with the United States of America today, the implosion, because there's no balance. In a patriarchal system, it's top down, whether it be the organized religions, the higher learning institutes, the corporate structure, the government, their structure, it's all top down. So in indigenous societies, and we're about 98% matrilineal, the structure is from the bottom, the foundation, and it's the women. And interesting enough, it's the older women that have already gone through the second change of life, and with them comes their wisdom, their experience. They've given life. We all have our intuitive power, and it's respected. And so these women are a big part of the society, and the appointing of the headsmen, the leaders within our societies, that's where that came from. So it was the strength of the woman that could see and look for the next minimum seven generations. And that's where a lot of our direction historically came from. And there's still vestiges of that throughout the indigenous world today. And that's what Russell really wanted to educate and to celebrate, is that we come from these societies of balance. How did we come about that balance? Well, it was adhering to that worldview of not only the female, but also all forms of life that live upon Grandmother the Earth, and Grandmother the Earth being a feminine energy, and the raping and the destruction that we are witnessing today is devastating to our worldview because of the respect that we have. That's where we come from. We have to continue that connection of the rhythms, the vibration, the frequency of our grandmother, the Earth.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests today are Pearl Dinetclaw Means, who is the widow of Russell Means, and also Lourdes Espinosa, who is from Santa Maria and who has made it possible for Pearl to come speak and sign Russell Means' latest book with Bayard Johnson, If You've Forgotten the Names of the Clouds, You've Lost Your Way, an introduction to American Indian thought and philosophy. The book signing is at 1 o'clock this Saturday, and the presentation at 3 o'clock at the Bookworm on East Bedaravia Road in Santa Maria. Pearl, will you please tell me what your vision is, and what are you going to do next?
Well, with the loss of Russell Means here in the physical, I feel like we all share in the responsibility of continuing his legacy. I have a couple of projects that I'm involved with currently. The current project is the book, getting the book out. It was one of the last things he did, so I know how important it was to him. He had published an ebook in 2012, and Bayard Johnson, his writing partner, and I just published it in softcover. I'm also working on the Russell Means documentary. The working title is Thunder on the Plains, and it's my vision to tie together all of the dots that Russell Means was a part of. We know him best as an activist, a patriot, Oglala Lakota patriot. He was also a constitutionalist. He was a writer, an artist, and he also did about 32 films. So he found the arts as another way to express and to share his message. He was very politically motivated. He was a history buff. He was a master orator. One of his speeches titled, it's actually been published several different ways, but I think it might be best known as, For America to Live, Europe Must Die. That speech categorized him as one of America's top 100 orators. So there's so many levels to this man's work and what it encompassed. So that is a current, a very exciting project, Thunder on the Plains, the Russell Means documentary.
You also are creating a Russell Means library. Can you tell me something about that?
I'm working with a young architect, very, very creative architect, and I'm beginning to develop the seed money for the endowment. But the Russell Means Library will be on his foundation land in Porcupine on the Pine Ridge Sioux Indian Reservation. It's a place where the family, will house his work, from the arts to the activism to the educational aspect, the political, his films, his music. All of his work, memorabilia, will be presented, along with the history of the Lakota. So it'll be a really nice place where people can come and learn and enjoy and participate in what this man dedicated his life to.
Lourdes, tell me, what is your vision and what are you going to do next?
I think the work that needs to be done is the work, for example, that Pearl is doing, that will give... We're actually helping to create a better world. I know I have my own work that I need to do. I have to tell the story of my parents, of my grandparents, because I can't forget that. That's important, their struggles. And who would be interested in that? Well, the children are interested in it. They want to know. They have that hope that we as adults can understand what they're going through and help them to face whatever they have to face every day. I work with children every day, so it keeps me inspired to keep going and to do whatever necessary work I need to do. So that's my vision for contributing to a better world.
Okay, thank you. Is there anything that I have missed that either of you wants to say about your work or the work of Russell Means? Pearl?
Well, I would just say that we all hold the responsibility for the next seven generations. And Russell's often said, freedom, the first step in freedom is you're free to be responsible. So if each one of us individually takes personal responsibility, what a beautiful world. What a beautiful world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pearl, Danette Clau-Means, and Lourdes Espinosa. Pearl Means will be signing Russell Means and Bayard Johnson's last book, If You've Forgotten the Names of the Clouds, You've Lost Your Way, and she will be giving a presentation at the Bookworm this coming Saturday in Santa Maria. The book signing is at 1 and the presentation is at 3 o'clock. For details, you can call the Bookworm at 922-4282. And for more information about Russell Means, you can visit russellmeans.com. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Underwriting support is made possible by WaterWise City of Santa Barbara, offering extensive online information on how to have a WaterWise garden. Let's save together at waterwisesb.org. Support is also provided by Cal Poly Arts and Otter Productions, presenting America's folk troubadour, John Prine, in concert on Friday, May 24th, at the San Luis Obispo Performing Arts Center. Advance reserve tickets are available at 756-4849. In just a bit, we'll take a spring cleaning trip to the Nipomo Swap Meet, but first, Julie Wheelock talks with an expert who can help you plant a garden that is less likely to cause allergies.
Coughing and wheezing and sneezing, oh my. But wait, there's hope for pollen victims. A guide to steer you away from those bad boy pollinators that attack your head and chest and toward the good plants and trees that treat you nicely. The book is called Allergy-Free Gardening, and it was written by Tom Ogren, a local horticulturist and allergy researcher. Tom had several reasons for writing this book, and some of them were his wife, his mother, and his sisters, who are all highly allergic to pollens. Tom admits he used to think allergies were pretty much psychosomatic, mostly because he didn't have any. But on a trip to Berkeley many years back, he made a connection that sent him down the garden path for real. He noticed that a whole lot of people were sick with hay fever and asthma, and he also saw that all the town's acacia trees were in full bloom. The possible illness acacia link got his attention, and when he returned to his job in San Luis, teaching horticulture to California Youth Authority students, he decided to do a little scientific experiment.
I got with a bunch of my students, and I explained what I was thinking about, and I asked them if they were game, how about we try sniffing a bunch of flowers and seeing if anybody got any reaction and see what we found. Everybody thought, oh, this was a great idea.
Flower sniffing, there's a concept.
Flower sniffing, yeah, right. Considering that I was teaching in the California Youth Authority, it's a lot better than glue sniffing and paint sniffing, which is very popular. And so we started out with petunias, and nobody had any effect. And then we sniffed pansies, and no one had any effect. We were going through a lot of different plants, and everyone was sniffing them and laughing about it. Nothing was happening at all. And we were growing a bunch of bottle brush there, and we cut off a sprig of lemon bottle brush, and a few of us sniffed it, and nothing happened. And then one guy sniffed it, and he immediately started to sneeze really bad.
That boy wasn't the only one who sneezed. Tom broadened his experiments to friends and family as well, including his mother, who also reacted to the bottle brush.
And it was really bad. I got her violently ill. Had a bout of asthma and everything else. And then I had another very bad effect with a nephew of mine with lemon bottle brush. And I finally decided I'd never sniff test anybody again with bottle brush because it was just too powerful.
Then Tom moved on to the job of re-landscaping his own yard to make it safer for his wife. He hunted everywhere for books on allergy-free gardening, but there weren't any. He consulted horticulture professors and explored university libraries and still found nothing to help him until he found some books about pollen.
And I would go up in the stacks and I would sit down and I'd pull out books that were literally covered with about a half inch or deeper of dust.
Did it make you sneeze?
Yes, and it did make me sneeze because dust is a pretty good allergen. It'll get almost anybody, and particularly at that measure. And I would sit there and I would read these books that had been sitting in these libraries sometimes 30, 40 years or more, and not one person had ever checked them out. And these were these books on pollen. And they're very complicated reading and written just primarily for botanists who are interested in the study of pollen for one reason or another.
After a really long time shut in with those dusty pollen books, Tom decided to take a big step and write his own guide to allergy-free gardening, which is when his book began to take shape.
At a certain point, I decided that what I ought to do is write something that was really good, that was about pollen and about how to avoid pollen, but that was written at a level where any gardener could understand it, where you didn't have to be a botanist with a PhD to understand it. And that's how I got into all of this. And I really, when I got in, I had no idea how heavy I was getting into because it consumed pretty much all my waking time and thinking for years now. And now I'm really hooked. It's like I can't stop now. I'm just get crazier and crazier on this.
After all that studying, Tom discovered an alarming fact. People who've always been allergy-free can develop allergies at any age, and he should know. He found out the hard way that he's not immune when he was cutting back his English ivy hedge one day. He was on a ladder, gathering in the branches as he trimmed them, when suddenly he sneezed so hard he fell right off the ladder and felt sick for the next 2 days.
What that was, I just had a big, massive, sudden allergic reaction to ivy pollen, and it came from one single heavy overexposure. This is something that people don't realize often, is that one real heavy overexposure to any allergen can suddenly cause allergies. For example, there's many cases of people who, through one way or another, got a very heavy exposure to a pesticide, particularly insecticides, and then suddenly after that they become allergic to a whole host of things that they were never allergic to before.
Those cross reactions can happen within any plant family. Here in San Luis, for instance, There are a lot of shrubs that are related to poison oak. They're all in the Anacardaceae family, and Tom says people who are allergic to poison oak can also develop allergies to any of those plants. In this town, that includes pepper trees, smoke bush, and Chinese pistache trees.
For example, here's something really curious, is I keep running into people who tell me that they've come down with poison oak, but they haven't contacted any poison oak, and they want to know, can you get poison oak if you weren't in poison oak? And the answer is, yeah, you can. And you don't even have to get it from the poison oak. You can get it from its relatives. And I think it's a serious concern that nobody's paid any attention to, but I think it's high time that we get on to this.
Besides those potentially dangerous cross-reactions, Tom also wants to draw attention to another horticultural fact of life. For those of us who hadn't really thought much about it, plants have pretty active sex lives for things that just sit in the ground. Tom's devoted a whole chapter to the subject, which explains his central message that male plants produce most of the airborne pollens that mess with our heads.
There are a bunch of different plant flowering systems, and to make it basic, there are some plants that are males, there are some plants that are females, and sure enough, there are some plants that are bisexual. And the biggest problem of all in allergy are the plants that are all males. And the thing that I discovered that pretty much blew me away when I did discover it was that the male plants are favored because they're what they call litter-free, meaning that the male plants males don't have any babies, they don't make any seed pods, they don't have any messy fruit, and so they call these clean. These plants have been favored all over, and I'm finding this all over the world. I'm finding this in Hong Kong, I'm finding it in New Zealand, I've found it in New York, and I've found it in California, and I've found it in between. For example, in San Luis, I could find a dozen species of plants used in landscaping here where fully 95% or more of all the plants in the town are male. So these strictly male plants, their pollen only moves one way, and that's through the wind. And people have become overexposed to the pollen of these male plants over the years, and as a result, their pollen is the most potent, it's the most allergenic, and it's now become terribly the most common.
Why have people chosen to plant these male plants in cities?
Right. They plant them because they don't want the litter on the sidewalk. And so, say you wanted to go down to the nursery here and buy a mulberry tree for your yard, they would sell you what they call a fruitless mulberry, and it would be all male. And in the springtime, right as we're talking right now, there would be tons of the pollen from that tree in the air, but there wouldn't be any hard litter on the ground. There wouldn't be any messy mulberry fruits, these messy seeds and stuff that come from the female plants.
Tom says one male plant that's been widely used throughout California because of its drought resistance is coyote bush, which is directly related to ragweed.
So if you already have a ragweed allergy and then you plant your yard into coyote brush as a ground cover, every fall you might as well have your whole yard full of ragweed.
Well, what's a person to do? Supposing you go to the nursery and you say, I want to buy all female plants. I don't want that ragweed stuff around me. What happens?
If you went to a nursery at this point in time and you asked for all female plants, they would probably laugh at you. And I don't think most of them would have a clue just what you were talking about. A lot of the nurseries aren't even aware about the plant sex themselves. They're selling these male clones, and they don't even realize a lot of times that they are selling males. They're just thinking that they're selling seedless or something. Well, the reason they're seedless is because they're male.
Tom's book offers guidance through this male-female bisexual plant maze, and he simplified the process by developing his OPAL scale, or Ogren's Plant Allergy Scale, that ranks plants from 1 to 10, 1 being least allergenic and 10 being watch out. The USDA has already made national use of the scale by having Tom rank their master list of thousands of urban trees and shrubs.
I see in the future that real savvy customers, gardeners who know their business, they're going to demand that at the nursery that they have a tag on each shrub or tree that they buy that gives it an allergy rating. So you can just look at this and you can go, oh, it's a 3. Obviously, it doesn't cause a great deal of allergy, no problem. But if you look at something else and it's rated a 9, you're going to ask yourself, do you want something rated a 9 in your yard? I wouldn't. I don't think that until we have this rating system pretty much standardized throughout horticulture that we will totally have a handle on the problem. But the rating system has been needed for many, many years. I mean, I never would have wrote the book in the first place had I been able to go down to the nursery and just everything was rated for allergy. I would have just bought the best ones, and I would have gone home and cut out the worst ones, and that would have been the end of the story. But there was no rating system until I created this system.
Tom sees our allergy rate as a fast-growing urban epidemic, not simply a seasonal nuisance. What can be done about it?
I'm doing everything that I can. I am talking everywhere I can talk. I am going all over the world trying to promote this book of mine. If I were already rich, honestly, and I didn't need a dime, I would still be doing the exact same thing that I'm doing right now because I believe so strongly in it. And I just think that all of this level of allergy is totally unnecessary, and that we have created this allergy precisely by what we are planting in our urban landscapes, and that we can just as easily reverse the whole thing. And that the faster I get the word out and the more people talk about it, the quicker something will be done about it. So I think that in the long run, we'll have to mandate about this, and we'll have to have pollen control ordinances, and we'll have to say, that's the law. We're not going to plant any more of this particular thing or whatever.
But, extreme measure or not, that percent of us who live with allergies might consider a national ranking scale really helpful. For sure, it would help Jane. She has a beautiful garden, but she has to be very careful how and when she enjoys it.
I'm cutting the buds off of my olive tree so it won't bloom, since I'm very allergic to it. Last year I cut out probably 70% of the branches before it bloomed, and it kept it from blooming, and it meant that I'm not inundated with all the pollen from the tree. Olive happens to be one of my worst allergies.
What happens to you when you're in contact with olives?
Well, the pollen causes me to get tracheitis, which is like asthma of the trachea, so that my trachea swells, I can't talk, and I'm in danger of not being able to breathe. And if I notice that if I don't use gloves when I'm pruning the olive, my hands get red and then start to itch. And I seem to be fine eating olives once they've been treated, but I just can't be around the olive tree. And it used to be only the blossoms, but now it's the branches too. But my target zone is mainly my trachea.
So you lose your voice.
Lose my voice, have trouble breathing. That's the more important part. I keep a epinephrine inhaler with me, and EpiPen in case that fails, and a liquid antihistamine, and I've been on shots for almost 6 years, twice a week.
But still you're willing to have a garden.
Oh, I love my garden. And it was really hard to not be out here for a couple years before my shots started working for me. So I wouldn't give up my garden.
And here's a final word of caution. People who think they're safe from allergies by using dried flowers at home should consider this Tom warning. Ragweed-related plants that are often used in dried flower arrangements can cause chronic allergies, even though they're dry. Also, allergy-prone people need to know that every part of a plant has the potential to cause allergies, stems, leaves, and bulbs, as well as the flowers. And even sweet odors from flowers like jasmine and gardenias can getcha. It's a jungle out there in the yard for sneezers and wheezers. If you want to rate your garden on Tom's Opal scale, have a look at his book, Allergy Free Gardening, from 10 Speed Press. And Tom's email address is TLOALLERGYFREE, that's TOL, allergy free, at earthlink.net.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. Krista Tippett talks with Jewish Buddhist teacher and psychotherapist Sylvia Borstein. Until then, let's take a spring cleaning trip to the Nipomo Swap Meet with Mary Schiller.
I took a walk through my neighborhood a few days ago. The first exercise I'd gotten in a week or two, I must confess. I was positively startled by the sudden explosion of spring. Oh, my fragrant red freesias had bloomed beside the golden daffodils in my yard. But gosh, when did the poppies, well, pop? When did the mustard flowers have time to grow so tall? I could barely see over them as I walked along the trail. I listened to the birds and, in my neighborhood, the lambs. All black fuzz and young curious eyes. I felt like I'd been asleep while all this blooming and birthing had been going on. The birds, the bees, the lambs, the breeze. And, oh yes, the va-va-va-vroom of the vacuum cleaner. Forget Easter baskets and chocolate bunnies. For me, spring is all about overflowing wastebaskets and dirty dust bunnies. Big ones, like the size of my cat. And let's not forget the shrunken green peas lying in wait in the corners of my kitchen. And a closet full of clothes that don't fit, have a permanent stain, or fall into the what on earth was I thinking category. Now, spring cleaning means different things to different people. Maybe it's time for you to make that once-a-year donation, or to have a garage sale. For some, it means setting up a table at the swap meet. The swap meet, huh? I suppose I have a few things, okay, maybe more than a few things, that somebody might want to pay a buck or two for. Out of curiosity, I decided to take a trip to the Nipomo swap meet and find out why people like the swap meet style of buying and selling. For all of a dollar, you can enter the mad world of the swap meet. These folks are mad about shopping and bargains and finding that one perfect thing, whatever it might be. And here's a little hint. They don't like to talk much while they shop. Oh, they're all really friendly. But they're not too crazy about being interrupted for radio interviews. After all, that one great thing could be leaving with someone else while they're talking to me. I did manage to corral a few of them, albeit briefly, long enough for them to tell me what they enjoy about the swap meet, in addition to the entertainment provided this particular day by Alexander Longrifle.
Oh, I've sold and bought at flea markets for quite a while. Santa Cruz and San Diego and stuff. Yeah, it's a place to go.
Joe Wadsworth and his friend Jeanette admitted to being swap meet regulars. In fact, Jeanette had a veritable laundry list of things she looks for at the swap meet.
Yes, old books, new books, books of nature, health, and different things like that. Yes, down jackets, Levi's. Shirts and things like that.
Jeanette was kind enough to offer me an excellent piece of advice, so pay attention now.
Down dress.
In between looking at books by Gibran, Joe and Jeanette told me what they like about shopping at the swap meet.
I mean, it's a good way of recycling stuff, and other people's garbage is our treasures, you know, so that's great.
I like to go. I just like to get out and see the people and be among them and wheel and deal, you know.
I have to admit, Jeanette's enthusiasm was pretty contagious. My next stop was a huge table covered in colorful plastic toys. Mowgli and Bagheera, Mickey and Minnie, Fred and Barney, they were all there. Ralph Lopez was happily digging through this big pile of toys. He was looking for something specific.
Well, I'm just looking for old Hot Wheel cars and stuff. I have a collection. Yeah, I have about maybe 200 or 300 of them. But I just pay a quarter for them. I don't pay like the big bucks. I just buy them because I like them. Not because they're worth money or whatever.
And why does Ralph like coming here? Aside from the Hot Wheels, that is.
You just never know what you're going to find, you know. You may be looking for something, you may not find it, and you may not be looking for something, you may see something that you just have to have. It may be here.
I was beginning to understand what people like about the swap meet. I mean, it's a really tactile experience. Picking up, touching things that used to belong to someone else, maybe that a child played with that now you can play with, or your child, of course. And we have been mandated to cut our landfill use, so what better way to do that than recycling your stuff? I was also starting to feel a little envious of the people selling stuff at the swap meet. I mean, what a life. Sit back, relax, soak up the sun. I asked Maynard Tolm from Seattle how he feels about selling at the swap meet. He had a nice selection of clothing for sale, which he explained were manufacturer samples.
Well, you meet a lot of nice people. It's very different. It's, you just sit around and do nothing, relax. Get out in the sun. Good to see the sun instead of the rain.
Nearby, Elaine Scott of Grover Beach had just purchased a couple of gifts. Gosh, come to think of it, you could do all your Christmas shopping in one day here.
I just like the ambiance of music and puppet shows and food and all that, and picking up things I can't find in a store.
Elaine reiterated a phrase I heard quite often as I asked people at the swap meet what they were looking for.
I'll know it when I see it. Can't live without it.
Ooh, Elaine mentioned the food. Have I told you it looks great? Corn dogs, popcorn, burritos, tacos, all that healthy stuff. And plus, there's a beautiful selection of fresh produce, fruits and vegetables, some really yummy-looking chilies, and some kind of scary-looking ones, too. Not to mention beautiful green cactus. Yum. As I wandered up and down the aisles, I came across Karen Horak's booth. I was particularly interested in knowing where she found all these wonderful items. Household things like china, grandma's candy dishes and cookie jars, things like that.
A lot of this collection was my mother's, and instead of storing it, we decided to try to sell it.
Karen admitted to being both a seller and a buyer. Here's why.
The people are nice, and the old stuff is really, you know, they're not making it anymore, and it's just a treasure, just fun.
And how do you know when you've found that special something?
It's what catches your eye that's colorful, and it just talks to you, speaks to me or something. You just know.
Shopper Lynn Arnsdorf just knew she had to have a few items from Karen's shop. She bought a graniteware coffee pot to use as a steamer on top of her fireplace, as well as some beautiful copper molds, small ones like you might use for butter.
And each one of these is different. They're really cute. I love this stuff, and I had this in my house, and I brought it over. A lot of those copper pots over there, I had them.
Yeah, those are nice.
Yeah, and I found out, I know you can clean copper with salt and lemon. You know, you dip the lemon in the salt, it really works. So.
Well, that's easier than the stuff I've been using.
Yeah, my graniteware. This was my mother's pot. And you know, sometimes these are worn inside, but you know what the people do with? That's not bad at all. They use them for cookie jars now.
Is that right?
Yeah, I've got all my mother's graniteware. I've got it in boxes and stuff. I won't part with it.
You know, I never did think of it. How thin is that on the bottom if I'm going to put water in it on the fireplace?
You can also, you know, it's in good shape. Most graniteware is beat up and chipped. This is an old one because it's got the handle. And you might even be able to, like, use the vinegar thing. That's not bad at all. That's just water scale.
Well, it's just going to hold water for steam, so it's not for anything else.
You may be wondering if I ever found that special something to take home. That one thing I just couldn't live without. Well, I was tempted by some beautiful wind chimes. They always signal the start of spring for me. I also met a cute and quite talented little red bird. Batteries not included. But in the end, what caught my attention were some silk flowers, daffodils like the ones growing in my yard, pansies, and white irises. Something pretty for me to look at while I wrestle those darn dust bunnies. Spring cleaning, here I come.
And that's Issues and Ideas for today. I'm Brian Lanzone. Up next, it's On Being. This is KCBX